Robert K. Massey writes huge, fat, and respected historical tomes every few years, and his fans open them like overstuffed candy boxes. The wax figures of history seem to step out into new life. Mr. Massey is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian who's perhaps best known for his books about the Russian royal family and the gathering forces of World War I. His new book is about the often unseen war that ushered in the 20th century, a conflict that could be unexpectedly stealthy, unprecedentedly personal, and brutal in new ways and on a new scale. His book is Castles of Steel, Britain, Germany, and the Winning of the Great War at Sea. Robert K. Massey joins us from our studios in New York, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
One is struck at first reading about the German royal family and the British royal family. This was a world war that was occasioned by, in some ways, a very personal quarrel between people who'd grown up together.
Absolutely. The Kaiser, William II, was Queen Victoria's eldest grandchild, and he had this strange and very powerful love-hate relationship with England, and this, because he was the Kaiser, worked itself out into policy and eventually into a military confrontation.
What was the combination of the advance of technology and also ambition that resulted in the device of these ships you refer to as the Castles of Steel?
First of all, we have to remember how very rapidly the technology had progressed in the 19th century. Battle of Trafalgar in 1804, which had given Britain worldwide naval supremacy, was fought with wooden sailing ships and old smoothbore cannon, the kind we now see in the film of Patrick O'Brien's Master and Commander. And in a very short space of time, as the Industrial Revolution sort of took over the technology of the economies of Europe, it also took over the navies, and warships became much bigger. They were built of steel. They had long rifled turret guns, which could hurl heavy shells over many miles. In the beginning of the 20th century, the British Navy, which was already the largest in the world, decided to revolutionize technology again and build what were called all big gun battleships, called dreadnoughts. And as the British started to build them, then the Germans started to build them. And so the British built more, and so the Germans built more. And you had the 20th century's first arms race. The weapons were not, of course, as lethal as the arms race from the Cold War, but they were very expensive and, for what they were, very deadly.
You have a section in here that was written by a midshipman on the battlecruiser, the Indomitable. If I could, I'd like to read that.
Yeah.
That midshipman wrote, "The furnaces devoured coal as fast as a man could feed them. Black, begrimed, and sweating men working in the shipside dug the coal out and loaded it into skids, which were then dragged along the steel deck and emptied on the floor plates in front of each boiler. If the ship rolled or pitched, there was always a risk that a loaded skid might slide and crush a man. Looking down from the iron catwalk above, the scene had all the appearance of one from Dante's Inferno. Watching the pressure gauges for any fall in steam pressure, the chief stoker walked to and fro, encouraging his men. Now and then the telegraph from the engine room would clang, and the finger on the dial would move round to the section marked, 'More steam.' The chief would press the reply gong with an oath, 'What do the bastards think we're doing? Come on, boys, shake it up, get going!' And the sweating men would redouble their efforts, throw open the furnace doors, and shovel still more coal into the blazing inferno." My gosh, yes. What a section.
Yeah. In fact, a substantial percentage of the crews of those great ships were stokers. And, of course, they never saw the enemy. They never saw the daylight. And if the ship were hit and sank, they had no chance of surviving.
The U-boat, submarine, if you please, was, I think we can fairly say, an American invention.
It was. It was an American invention devised by an Irish-American who came to the United States and wanted to devise a craft which could sink the British Navy.
Well, and as it was developed by the German Navy, it came close to that, didn't it?
It did, and that story is fascinating. That's the sort of the second half of this story of the Sea War, when after the dreadnoughts had clashed, had battered each other and killed thousands and thousands of seamen at the Battle of Jutland, or the Germans call it the Battle of Skagerrak, it was inconclusive, because the Germans went home, and the Kaiser wouldn't really let them come out again in any situation where they were likely to meet the British Navy again. So how to break the British blockade, which was starving the German people? How to put a blockade around the British Isles so Germany could starve the British people? Mm-hmm. And the answer was the U-boat, a small sort of puny little weapon at the beginning of the war, but technology expands with lightning speed during wartime, and by 1916, German U-boats were very powerful, ocean-going craft with 16 torpedoes. And the upshot of all of that was that in order to throw this blockade around Britain, they began torpedoing anything without warning. Neutrals meant the United States. Mm-hmm. American cargo vessels were sinking. American lives were being lost. Any country which didn't want to be involved in this war, it was the United States. Any president who was peacefully inclined, it was Woodrow Wilson, re-elected in 1916, on the platform of he kept us out of war. But suddenly, such pummeling, such trampling of American rights, at least as the Americans saw it, was going on because of U-boat warfare that the United States came into the war.
How was the U-boat set back, defeated?
It was set back by a combination of tactics. First of all, the greatest American contribution at sea was that we sent over almost all of our destroyers to help in the convoying of merchant ships, which made the U-boats beware and stay away. Before that, ships had just sort of sailed on their own, and the U-boats had picked them off. The second, or the third, I guess, the destroyers, the convoys, was the development of the depth charge. Somebody had the intelligence to figure out how to set a hydrostatic fuse, which would respond to water pressure, and try and set the depth setting where the U-boat was. And, of course, the power of a 300 pounds of the explosive going off anywhere near a submarine creates an enormous shock wave, and a lot of U-boats didn't get home.
Mm-hmm. The book ends with the scuttling of the German Navy.
That was the extraordinary denouement. The fleet, as a result of the armistice, was gathered together, and the German fleet, and brought across to Britain, taken up to this great harbor, the great naval base of Scapa Flow in the Orkneys. And they spent the winter there while the diplomats argued about what the treaty which would end the war would look like, eventually the Treaty of Versailles. And finally, by May, no treaty had been signed. Meanwhile, the ships with skeleton crews had been sort of rocking at anchor up in these harbors. There was a breakdown of communications. The admiral, German admiral in charge of these ships, didn't get the word that the deadline had been extended. And he decided that the honor of the German Navy demanded that the ships not be surrendered. So one bright spring morning, when the watching British squadron had gone out to sea to exercise, they quite literally pulled the plugs. And within 3 or 4 hours, 70 great German warships went to the bottom of this harbor. And that's where my book ends, with the sort of, that was the last act of the war. The treaty was signed at Versailles a week later. And for better or for worse, Europe was at peace.
Mr. Massey, thank you.
Thank you.
Robert K. Massey, his new book is Castles of Steel, Britain, Germany, and the Winning of the Great War at Sea.